Welcome back to Coast AM. So, have you read the headlines about the measles outbreaks or about the opioid epidemic or any of the headlines that really seem to be written by drug companies? What about the truth behind the headlines? What about the facts, the real facts behind these headlines? Joining me tonight is Dr. Paul Anderson. He's a medical doctor who specializes in research and developing natural treatments and remedies for some of our incurables. He himself had a 7-year arthritic pain, knee pain, that he realized the power of natural treatments. He devoted himself to finding the natural treatments, and he actually healed his knee pain. And he has an incredible ability to research and understands the research behind the facts and what is really going on behind chronic pain and arthritis and excessive weight and poor sleep and bad brain health and all of that. And he found that there are ways to relieve that without drugs or surgery. So we will be back with Dr. Paul Anderson to talk about all of these great real facts. I am Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar. My guest is Dr. Paul Anderson, who is no stranger to pain. He ran one of the largest pain clinics in the world. Knows a lot about addiction, about pain, about all sorts of treatments for pain, and really discovered that you can really treat most levels of pain with natural treatment and without drugs or surgery. Welcome, Dr. Paul. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
We're going to talk about all sorts of stuff today, the truth behind the measles reporting and all sorts of things. But let's start with you, basically. How did you discover that you could actually heal yourself from the arthritic knee pain that you had?
I'd have to say it started in medical school. I was exposed to an acupuncture course when I was a young physician, and it was quite heresy to be looking at acupuncture. And I trained with the world's leading orthopedic surgeon in Toronto, and he used chiropractors for
Wow.
people he couldn't heal. So, I mean, this is going back 30 plus years. So, I got exposed to that very early. And early on in my career, there wasn't a lot of choices on the natural side. And as the science got better, there was more and more choices eventually where we were able to go mostly to non-opioid pain treatment. There's still some that require it, but it allowed us a lot more flexibility. And especially the last few years, Lisa, the research has allowed us to understand much better the problems we're dealing with, particularly the pain brain. So our options are more now. We understand a lot better, but unfortunately, we've gotten in the throes of this opioid crisis, which is just basically pharmaceutical greed.
We're going to get to that for a second, but let's talk about this pain brain. What do opioids do to the brain?
So opioids, and they mimic your own natural painkillers, endorphins. And it sounds wonderful, except there's a few problems. The first problem is that when you take opioids regularly, after a while, half your pain is rebound pain from the opioids themselves. So people start to take more and more opioids because it's not working. Also, if they come off the opioids, they have withdrawal and they have massive amount of pain as the pain receptors start to reset.
Come back. Oh, so it's even worse.
Right. So, I mean, when you look at pain clinics, depending on if it's Europe or North America, anywhere from a third to a half of the pain problems are actually from the drugs. It's interesting, in Toronto, the last few years, the neurologists refused to see a chronic headache sufferer unless they come off all drugs for 2 months. Because what they're trying to do is wash them out so that they know that what pain is real, not caused by this rebound cycle. And it's a major problem. It's not only opioids, it's also nonsteroidal drugs, and caffeine are sort of the three notorious ones. There's others as well.
My friend. Well, I mean, so this is interesting. So those things, when you go off of them, makes it even worse because, for example, the caffeine, the stimulation that the caffeine gives you, it suppresses your own body's natural stimulation.
Yes. So what happens is It desensitizes your pain receptors and your ability to make endorphins. And so what happens is you make less endorphins and your pain receptors are less sensitive to them. So it's a really vicious cycle. And that was one of the things we used to do in the clinic was for the first 10 to 14 days is we would wash people out. You know, whether it was opioids or barbiturates, there's still a lot of people using barbiturates, believe it or not, even today for chronic pain and caffeine. We would wash them all out of that for 10 to 14 days. And most people, half or more of their pain was gone, regardless of cause.
Huh.
It was a physiological cause, that is.
Oh, my goodness. So would they stay at the clinic while you were doing that? What type of process did you use for that level of detoxification?
So one of the things we learned was you can't get people off their medication unless you offer them alternatives. So we would offer them, we had 32 different therapies in the clinic. We would offer them and use different combinations, find the right combination for them, whether it was a combination of acupuncture, Chinese massage, herbs, lasers, supplements, meditation, whatever those things were to get them through. And the other big thing was educating people so they understood, look, we would partner with them and say, if we can do this, then, you know, for 10 to 14 days, you're going to feel a whole lot better. There's no other way of doing this. And we found with education and doing those other things, we had a really high success rate.
So if you could
get them off the medication, yeah.
If you could get through that window of the 10 to 14 days, then the body can actually rebound its own natural pain receptors and killers in the brain, or endorphins or whatever it is, the body will actually rebound. Does it matter the amount of abuse that you've done to it?
I never thought of it that way, because we've had the most I've ever saw was the guy taking 60 Tylenol number ones a day. Dude, I was surprised he was alive.
Wow. His liver was still intact,
so,
yeah.
The more they take, the longer it usually takes, because they don't usually start them cold turkey, especially the barbiturates or the caffeine. We gradually cut them down, so sometimes it takes some time. But, you know, most within 2 weeks, occasionally it goes to 30 days, and most of the time we can wash them out. Mm. And as the level started to drop, they started to recover.
So now we hear from the drug companies that fentanyl and these oxycodone and so forth are not addicting, right?
Okay. Fantasy Island's closed. You know, I don't know where this came from, but it's ludicrous. I mean, it's not, it is so untrue. First, let's talk about fentanyl. Fentanyl should be taken off the market.
What is fentanyl? What does it do?
Fentanyl is just an incredibly powerful opioid. So if you or I even touch it and get it into us, so an amount small enough to be on your baby finger or your little finger, the size of your nail, is enough to kill an average adult.
That's what happened with Michael Jackson, right?
Well, yeah, he was also doing propanol too, which was a whole other story.
Okay.
So just the idea that you have something that powerful in that small of a package, it shouldn't be on the market. It's just too dangerous. So that's the first thing. But the idea that this about addiction is very interesting, because if you look at chronic pain, 20% of chronic pain patients are addicts. Now, that's a fact. We've known this for. So the problem you have is if 100 people walk through the door that have chronic pain, 80% of them aren't addicts, but 20% are addicts who happen to have pain. So the idea that the risk is low is 20% of the population already are addicts, and there's people that are very susceptible. So as soon as you start handing out narcotics or opioids, The problem is those people that have never, their brains have never experienced, they might be depressed, they may not have a lot of energy, they may not feel really good about themselves, whatever that is. The brain's just not happy. The neurochemistry is off. And they discover the joy of opioids, especially fentanyl. Fentanyl is so powerful. as soon as they discover that feeling, they become addicted.
And that's if they were naturally depressed, so meaning they might have had lower levels of serotonin production naturally.
Yeah, it could be serotonin, it could be dopamine, their endorphin production could be low. Usually there's electrical problems in the brain, whether that's inherited or from trauma, but there's really altered brain chemistry, like you were saying. And you can't not expect to be treating this population without having a lot of addiction. That's the first thing. So the FDA either didn't do anything or agreed with the message that if properly managed, there's no the addiction risk is small. No, it's actually quite large. And we've known this for over 30 years. This isn't new. And other drugs, one of them particularly was Stadol, in America is a narcotic you spray intranasally, voluntarily went off. They were not scheduled as a narcotic. They went to the FDA and say, we are a narcotic and we are addictive. That's 20 plus years ago. So, like, this is well known. And the idea that it wasn't known by the drug companies and the scientists is absurd. I mean,
it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's known. But the doctors are equally at fault because they just push the narcotics or opioids, and I use narcotics, this is the older term, without understanding that there is major addiction risk and that if you are going to use them, you use them in very specific amounts and you decrease it very quickly. What you can't do is give them out liberally, and that's what's still going on to this day. You know, personal story, went for an orthopedic procedure in the hospital. It wasn't my knee, it was my hip. And I asked for no opioids. They fought me. They fought me from intake to the surgery, and I caught the nurse putting opioids in my IV bag.
Wow.
And here's someone who's saying, I don't want them, I don't need them. I wasn't complaining about pain, yet they were pushing opioids and large amounts of morphine.
Wow, as a part of a protocol?
Yep.
And for a hip surgery. Wow.
Yeah, and it's like, this is exactly what you shouldn't be doing. So
that is crazy.
Huh. Yeah, the doctors are part of the problem. They need more education, but they need to really understand it. Yes, there's some people that need them. There's, you know, there's cluster headache sufferers. There's people with neuropathic pain where nothing works. And you need to manage them. But again, same thing. You've got to manage them carefully. You give them amounts in certain quantities that, and you watch it. If they're escalating, you know you're getting into an addiction problem. They're escalating, trying to escalate constantly.
Escalating the medication.
Right. Uh-huh. Or they go onto a pain pump, same thing. You really got to watch them. And so there's well-trained physicians, but a lot of physicians are just not aware. And the drug companies went out, and the reps who are usually very charming and they've got all these studies are pushing this message, oh, you don't have to worry, you don't have to worry, you don't have to worry. And, yeah, you have to do your own researches. You do have to worry.
Wow. And I mean, it's fascinating the way you explain it, that it sets you up for when you go off of it, it's even worse. The pain is even worse because it suppresses the body's brain's natural pain killers. And so that is why the addiction is so high. Now, what are some types of natural things that people can do for pain that really work?
So one of the things we've learned in the last 10 years, which we didn't know before, there were some people that didn't respond well, and it was just a group that didn't do well. They were often had depression. They had other problems, medical problems. And it turns out there's something called undermethylators. And it's very common. It's very common in depression, and it's very common in chronic pain. So you need to be tested for it. Most people are getting tested to 23andMe, but 23andMe just sort of gives you the raw data, and then it has to be put through an interpreter. There's several online you can use. And what you're really trying to find out is, do you methylate folate or not? And do you have a double defect in the genes? And if you do, you're an undermethylator, My advice is to get the testing done by someone who really understands this area, and also get your homocysteine levels measured. Homocysteine is a compound that tells you how well you detoxify.
Okay.
And the other thing that happens with non-methylators is they can't detox.
Is that what methylation is? Is it detoxification in the body?
It's actually, methylation is part of every pathway in the body. So, for example, if you can't methylate folate, which just means you're just adding a carbon and some hydrogen to a folate, which then hands that off to B12, and then methylated B12 actually runs into your whole detox pathway, and it runs into all your neurotransmitters in your brain. So whether that's endorphins, dopamine, serotonin, all of this is affected by methylation. And it's a major, so if you don't know you're an under-methylator,
That's huge.
You do all the treatments you want, it's not going to be enough.
Not going to make a difference. I mean, this actually goes into our vaccine conversation. Because if a child is an under-methylator, there's got to be a test for babies to determine whether or not they can methylate a vaccine before they are vaccinated. That should be absolutely standard protocol, is babies should be tested for their ability to detoxify before any vaccine is given. Don't you agree?
Well, definitely all of us need to be tested for this. And although the story is not simple, it turns out to be quite complicated, because it's, and the biochemistry is very difficult for even well-trained people, and we just don't know enough. Because if you were an under-methylated, you would think by taking methylated B12 or methylated folate, you could solve your problem, and it doesn't always work. We've actually had cases where it's made people worse. So there's a hidden problem in there, Lisa. We don't know what that is, but a good number of people improve. It's also interesting, and this is where it's going to go, is there's bacteria, probiotic bacteria, that actually will methylate your B12 and your folate for you.
Ah.
And there's populations around the planet, and there's one group in Sri Lanka where they were studied, because they were all under methylators, and they're absolutely healthy and fine. It turns out their probiotic bacteria were little B12 methylated B12 factories. So there's an interplay with your biome here that we don't really understand completely. We don't understand the pathways, but that would be one thing I would say you need to be tested for.
Fascinating. So it's really, this is just a whole point of understanding what methylation is.
Yes, and we're just at the infancy of that.
Yeah.
But we've had enough success with giving people methylated B12. And what's interesting is, say someone's taking B12 or taking folate and it's not methylated, and they're an under-methylator, it actually makes them worse, because they get toxic levels because they can't process vitamins because they never move on in the pathway. Mm. So those people get quite sick from B12 and folate unless they're methylated. And even those amounts have to be done very carefully. So that's one thing, you know, to test for yourself. The other is your D3 level. Almost all the chronic pain patients that came through were very deficient in D3. And it's very confusing out there, how much to take, when to take. There's been a concerted effort the last 2 years. There's been dozens of articles in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. on the evils of D3, which is extraordinary, because between myself and my colleagues, we've probably prescribed over 10,000 plus people D3. Not one of us have ever seen a side effect, ever.
Oh.
Not one.
Why all of a sudden is it bad for you?
All these side effects listed, we've never seen it. And, like, go get tested. The second thing is the amount they tell you to take is, you should be taking 800 IUs or 1,000 IUs.
Mm-hmm. 10,000, I've heard.
Well, this is the experts. That are putting in the standards that the U.S. is 800 IUs, Canada's 1,000. We find most people need 4,000 to 10,000 IUs a day to be effective. Like, if you actually measure the blood, and this sort of brings up a point about all these experts that are against things or talking about things, and they have no experience.
Wow. You've
given it to thousands and thousands of people.
And you have clinical experience. Oh my
We've
gosh.
done it.
We could keep talking. We have to take a quick break. Dr. Paul, just hang on for me. Lots of great information coming up with Dr. Paul Anderson. His website, by the way, drpaulsnaturals.com. We will be right back. I'm Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar. My guest, Dr. Paul Anderson, will be back in just a minute talking about methylation and all sorts of fascinating topics around pain and addiction and good stuff. So I also want to remind you, if you go to the our wonderful network that I'm appearing on starting in a couple of hours called freespeech.org. Free Speech is a network that really is free. That's exactly what it is, talking about news behind the news, a lot of great progressive topics on there, and all alike, all topics and politics. And my show particularly has to do around personal issues around happiness, health, personal growth. And it starts at 6 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Eastern. So check that out at freespeech.org. We will be right back. I am Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is Dr. Paul Anderson. We've been talking about, he's a pain specialist and specializing in natural therapies around pain. And we talked a little bit about, well, a lot about the opioid epidemic and finding that people are under methylating. And those are the types of people that really should not take opioids because they won't be sufficient. They need to go through testing. And am I getting this right, Paul?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So finding some type of testing, it could be 23andMe or it could be some type of testing to find out if you are a methylator or not, or undermethylator. This is important. And tell me again what methylation, undermethylating means.
So all the major systems in your body use methyl, which is just carbon and some hydrogens, and particularly the folate and B12 need to exchange a methyl group. And there's a large percentage of the population that have pain and depression that are unable to methylate folate. And then B12 doesn't get methylated, and then your detox pathway doesn't work, so homocysteine levels rise. And you don't make all your neurochemicals in your brain, the important ones, serotonin, dopamine, endorphins, and so on. So it's an important thing to get tested for. So usually it's 23andMe or something like that, and there's an interpreter software, and then you usually go on a trial of methylated folate or B12.
And this would uncover why you would find yourself being depressed all the time or in pain all the time, because there's just a certain type of altered brain chemistry that's happening. Not your fault.
Right. And that's same with the D3. It's interesting, all this sort of propaganda against D3, which is simply what it is. But none of them talk about seasonal affective disorder and chronic pain levels. One of the things that we know is that low D3 leads to pain, but it also leads to seasonal affective disorder, which originally was thought to be just due to light. But light's only about 10% of the problem for most people. 90% plus is usually the D3 deficiency. So, for example, I'm a SAD sufferer, and I need to take about 5,000 IUs of D3 a day. If I listened to these other experts, I would be depressed all year round.
Wow. Even though you live in a sunny area, it doesn't matter. Sunlight doesn't matter.
Get enough. Yeah, well, the problem is with skin, right, because you're supposed to, you know, you want to look after your skin and not get skin cancer and not get too much exposure. Well, when you do that, you don't get enough D3. So if you're using sunscreens, then you can't make enough D3 through your skin, especially if you have a darker skin. So getting enough D3 turns out to be a very important foundational vitamin, especially in my area of medicine. And we use it a lot. And it also helps with sleep, which is the other thing that's really important for pain patients, other than getting them off their opioids and caffeine and other drugs. We wash them out. We know to check them, get their methylators. We test their D3, we put them on D3. I mean, these are great things to start. But sleep, we find that if we can get a good night's sleep into them for two nights in a row, about 50% of the pain goes away.
Wow. Now, is liquid D3 better than the tablets, or is there one you recommend?
So liquid or the gel, where they're liquid inside the gel, because vitamin 3 is fat soluble, so you don't want to use. Tablets don't work so well. We use several really good brands out there. The trick is to take it at night for most people. So 99 out of 100 people, it really helps their sleep if they take their D3 at night. One out of 100, it actually wakes them up because it turns on their dopamine, so they have to take it in the morning. But whether you take it in the morning or you take it at night, it does support your serotonin. It does support melatonin for sleep.
Ah, so if you take it at night, you could wake up happier.
That is the part of the trick. So that's part of our sleep protocol. First of all, we always said if there's any question of sleep apnea is associated with chronic pain, especially headaches. So if you snore or your partner or someone told you to ever stop breathing, it's off to the sleep lab. That really needs to be determined. We just recently had someone that had terrible chronic migraines for years. She was in her 50s. She got an MRI. We ruled a brain tumor, but then we found out that she had bad sleep apnea. We treated it, and her pain's all gone.
Wow. Fascinating.
So that's something to do. And then also right now with the light, all these devices, iPads, iPhones, Androids, tablets, whatever you use in computers.
Right.
It turns out that if you can turn off the blue light, it really helps a lot.
Blue light filters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the phones, especially the Androids and the iPhones, there is the ability to turn off. So we recommend people turn it off so that the blue light is minimized as much as possible throughout the day. And light plays a huge part of sleep. So the other thing to realize at night, you want to be turning the lights down. So the light's dimming just like it's the sunset. And you want to turn off everything that's stimulating, particularly things like the news or television in the bedroom. Mm-hmm. All of that's got to go. The bedroom has to be dark. And having this really good sleep hygiene. And then we add into that, we use something called cranial electrical stimulation, which is Russian electric sleep. There's several companies that sell these devices. We found it to be very effective.
What is that? Cranial electrical stimulation to help you sleep?
Cranial electrical stimulation is very interesting. The Russians invented it for their cosmonauts. It came over into America about 1985, and we got hold of it about 20 years ago and have used it very successfully for sleep.
Is it like a really good head massage or something?
No, what it does is there's little ear clips that go on your earlobes, like clip-on earrings.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out there's an acupuncture anesthetic point there that really pushes up serotonin. So they also use it for depression and anxiety.
Hmm.
But we found it excellent for sleep. So you put it on at night, you turn down the lights, you take your D3, we use double-release melatonin, very small amounts. And sometimes we have to add in some 5-HTP or L-tryptophan to boost the serotonin. Give them that little sleep cocktail, and usually within a few days, we've got them sleeping quite well.
Ah, fascinating. That is a great combination. See, all natural treatment, and it's just a combination of the right things. All right, well, let's talk, if we can, about this. I mentioned earlier about this whole idea behind the measles reporting. Now, I understand that there's a lot of propaganda out there right now. There have been almost 1,000 cases of measles reported since the start of the year. Is this something that you're talking about that you would think would be pharmaceutically reported on? Is there a reason why the drug companies would want to have these headlines written?
Well, yes, I think the reason is that they want to stop people that are electing to not vaccinate their children, and they want the whole pie, right? They're not satisfied. They have 99%. They want the whole pie. If we just look at the numbers for a second, if you look at causes of death and the concerns about the amount of measles cases, first of all, you're not going to get measles in your children generally if they get vaccinated. So there's only a small number in America that are electing not to do it. And there is some risk with that. And if you're doing it, then you understand you're taking that risk for you and your children. But according to the CDC, even if there was 3 to 4 million cases of measles, 3 to 4 million cases of measles, the number of deaths would be 400 to 500 a year. To put that in perspective, the number of people that die from medical errors a year, this is including prescription drugs, not just pain medication or opioids, but all prescription drugs, and medical mistakes is the number three leading cause at about 120,000 deaths a year. Just to put it in perspective. So you'd have to have, so we might have 2,500 cases of measles this year. You'd have to have millions before there's any sort of significant death rate. And it's very, still very, very low. It's like zero. The CDC is, it's sort of inconsistent. The death rate's 0.01% to 0.1%. It's very small.
So if there were 1,000 measles cases reported in the United States, it would be a 0.000.
Well, no, it might be like one in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000. So the mortality is very low. But when I was training as a physician, the main risk of measles was actually the rubella. So the mumps, measles, rubella vaccination is rubella. The German measles, the problem is it causes birth defects, and it's pretty
in pregnant women.
And it's, so that's a major concern, because that actually is a pretty significant and common side effect of the German measles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're gonna not vaccinate your child, and realize that yes, there is risk because people that come from third world countries bring measles back in, and your child may get it. The risk of something happening is low, but there is risk. But in terms of there being an epidemic in America and being concerned, and when we got, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 cases at the end of the year, is fractional.
Doesn't an epidemic have to be a tipping point?
It's not even. There is no epidemic.
Right.
There's some small outbreaks that are just tiny.
Right.
And, you know, it brings up the whole vaccination discussion. In America, it's unbelievable that they're recommending 19 vaccines, right?
Before the age of 24
months.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what's even worse is at times they get four different shots, like in 2 and 4 months, they get four different. You know, the way to just sort of put it in perspective and some common sense is those are 19 toxins.
Yeah. Before the immune system is even developed.
It's not even formed. Not even formed. You're using your mother's immune system. Yours isn't formed. All your nervous system, all the tissue is open, right? You haven't fully myelinated. You haven't fully developed. You're actually growing at the same time. This is the worst time to be inducing any type of toxicity, let alone man-made toxins, because you're altering the bacteria and the viruses, and you're injecting this poor, defenseless immune system. And I understand why parents wouldn't want to do it. I absolutely agree that needs to be looked at, and it's not reasonable. I looked at it yesterday after we spoke, and looked at all the diseases they're doing. They're so uncommon, and like, why would you even bother vaccinating against that? All you're doing is creating risk. The child, there's still mercury in them. There's still formaldehyde if they're using the multi-dose influenza.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's still aluminum. So those are well-known neurotoxins. I don't see, all I see is drug company propaganda.
Well, you would also have to know if their child is able to methylate those types of toxins.
There is testing. There's known children that are at risk, and it's generally ignored. You know, it's not tested for.
There is testing available, but it is ignored. Yes,
it is ignored. I must say that I don't have children, but if I had children, I would not vaccinate.
It's definitely
19 is ridiculous.
Well, you would have to also learn about it, because as I said earlier, I think there has to be a mandatory test that is taken, that is done on the baby first, to see if those detoxification pathways are even open in order to methylate or detoxify the toxins, the neurotoxins in those vaccinations, the formaldehyde and the thimerosal and all that.
But just think about what you're saying. We're saying is we're still going to do it despite that. Even if those pathways are there and intact, it doesn't mean that they're going to be able to hold off 19 toxins.
Right, which then again, you could wait a little bit longer. I mean, 3, 4 years, 13, 14 years. I mean, there's got to be a different protocol for this specific vaccine conversation. I don't think it's a yes or no conversation. There's got to be a different protocol involved, and that has yet to be researched. I mean, maybe it's in process, maybe it is, but it has to be reworked, and it's going to continue to be a big debate until there's some reasonable and factual information around the schedule of the vaccinations, the reporting of the numbers of diseases and so forth. It's a long conversation. Most of our phone calls right now that are coming in right now, however, are about the pain. And you have a lot of information about this because you have run a pain clinic. Tell me a little bit about the pain clinic that you ran, and where was it? It was in Canada?
It was in Canada, and they're probably calling and looking for some other solutions. So one of the other things we put in the clinic very early on was from Dr. John Kabat-Zinn.
Oh, yeah.
In the early 80s, he brought Tibetan meditation into a clinical setting to treat chronic pain patients. And that was just heresy. Mm. You know, he's in the Midwest. I mean, that's insanity. Mm-hmm. And he did a 6-week program where he teaches chronic pain patients to meditate an hour a day. And it's been studied. He gets about a 65% reduction in pain just from the meditation alone. And we were so fascinated that in the early 90s, we sent one of our clinicians down to train with him. We actually brought his type of meditation into the clinic. We also did Qigong and Tai Chi. And we found that it made an enormous difference to the patients. And we also used some technology called audiovisual entrainment from a company out of Canada called Mind Alive. And that helps people meditate, because so often when they were in chronic pain, they couldn't meditate that well. So we used the technology as a way to help them meditate. And that was a really wonderful thing that they could do. And originally it was an hour, and then Dr. Henry Benson out of Massachusetts showed that if you meditated just 15 minutes a day, or you can use deep spiritual prayer, that in 1 month, 2,000 inflammatory genes would turn off.
Oh, my goodness. I was just going to ask you what meditation does to the pain centers in the brain.
It raises the endorphins, and it raises them very well. So imagine if you're taking them off the opioids and the caffeine and the other nonsteroidals and all the other drugs they're taking at the same time, you're titrating them smartly. You're also getting them to meditate. You're getting them to sleep, right? Wow, now we're getting somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Turns off the pain receptors. It raises endorphins. It raises serotonin levels.
Yes.
Supplements do this. I mean, that's really interesting.
Yes, that worked very well in terms of helping them. And then we also use Russian lasers back in the day when the Russian laser technology came in. And the Russians brought in these cold lasers that were very low powered, and treatment times was about an hour. These are from different types of pain, very successfully. And then what happened in North America was these cold lasers were suddenly, the Americans like to power things. So then it was like, we'll make it more powerful and then we can do 20-minute treatments and 5-minute treatments. And what we found from the Europeans was low and slow. But if you're going to put energy in the body, it should be low and slow.
To match the body's frequency.
Right. So the lasers that I use now are out of Toronto, but the physician, one of the physicians there is Russian. And they work with an institute out of Russia. And again, the average treatment time for the lasers, just about an hour.
Hmm. Very interesting.
And again, low and slow. Mm-hmm. And that also really reduces inflammation and boosts endorphins.
Reduces inflammation. Oh, that's a big topic. All right. Well, we're going to actually get to take a quick break here, Dr. Paul, and we're going to come back, talk about inflammation, and take some phone calls about people who really have a lot of questions about the opiates and the pain. All right. We'll be right back. You are listening to Coast to Coast AM. Mm-hmm.